Hello?
Are you there? Okay,
Yeah, I'm
cool. Can you hear
here.
me?
I'm
Okay.
here.
That's
Yeah,
great.
and it said
Amazing.
and it said recording started, so we're actually recording.
Oh, we're online.
Yeah, this is a free service too. Well, anyway, for 14-day trial. So, if all goes
Amazing.
well, this is great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good that we had the chance to chat before you actually
Yeah.
needed all this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I get my sillies out
We
now.
get all the laughs out of our system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we don't. We can laugh. Laughing is good. It's
Yeah,
good for
it
the soul, you
is.
know?
Exactly.
It's not all about being somber, right?
Yeah,
It's adventure. It's
definitely.
fun, right?
Completely. Yeah,
Yeah.
I get it.
Okay, so.
We just had a laugh hysterically,
Yeah, that's good.
no
That's
pun
cool.
intended.
You know, it's funny because I don't know. I must have been tuning into your energy or something like that before because
Yeah, you got really
seriously,
good.
I
Can't
must
say
have,
too much.
right?
Can't take life too seriously.
No,
Leave stuff for
I must have. I'm like,
leave
this,
stuff
I
to
could
take
th
all
I I'm sure I would have fun with this person.
the time.
Yeah,
That's
it's
the best
good.
to play it anyway. Yeah,
Yeah,
awesome.
yeah. Okay. So, okay. Do you want to get all official now?
Yes, let's do it. Let's go hard. That sounds good. Yeah, awesome.
Okay. So, I introduced you, and now here we are live. All right. So, Nathan, it's wonderful to have you here for the Leaders Call to Adventure Telesummit. Really honored to have you on the call today. And of course, I've read your book, and it was phenomenal. And I'm, very much, I guess, in awe of the journey that you've undertook, and everything that you faced on that journey. But for those that are on the call and are not familiar and haven't read the book, let's just dive in right from the beginning, and you tell me whatever possessed you to undertake this walk.
Well, basically, I mean, if I'm completely honest, it's kind of it was like all ego initially. I just had this call up and read this invitation to go and be the first Westerners in history to walk the length of the Great Wall, the first group of Westerners anyway. And my kind of ego reared up and thought, yeah, cool, I'll give that a crack. But I mean, that was probably the initial impetus. But I mean, if I'm really honest, I was working as a lawyer up in Alaska, and I was visiting this gallery one time, and there's a photo gallery of all these kind of glaciers, and it was quite an impressive little showing. But there are these two photos of China, and they just stood right out from all the other photos, and I just had this very, very strong draw to these two photos. And now I had no idea that I'd go to China later on in the future, but I just knew in that moment that there was something going on and I would be in that country. I didn't have any desire at all to go to China at that stage. And okay, about 6 to 8 months later, I got this first email from a friend who was working with my twin brother in London on an aerial theatre show called Dilawada. And he'd been invited by a Buddhist monk who'd come up with the idea to go and walk the wall, and was basically trying to find other members to kind of complete a documentary on this guy's walk. So that's when the invitation came to me. So initially it was like I had a lot of fear and I didn't really want to do it. But then when he said I would be the first group of Westerners, then my ego was like, yeah, man, I'll give this a crack. And that kind of essentially got us out there in the first place, that whole ego thing. But once we got out there, and I mean that was a whole month and a half of sort of umming and ahhing and preparing and being scared pretty much out of my wits in terms of the whole idea of the journey. But once we got out there, it was just quite different, because we took a 2-day train from Beijing, and we'd been in Beijing for about 3 weeks preparing, just learning as much language as we could, just to get a little bit of the language so we could survive out there, because I didn't know a word of Chinese at all before I got to China. I mean, I had travelled through about 50 countries before that stage. I was used to being around other cultures and being in one place one day, another place the next day, and I was very used to and very much enjoyed that type of lifestyle of living. But in terms of taking on this whole new sort of alien culture, it was completely new. So we just had that time to prepare. And when we got out there, that 2-day train ride, and I was sitting at the very first watchtower of the Great Wall, and basically, just to put it in visual context, you've got this the Himalayas right to the back of the south of you. So they just stretch as far as I can see to the south. And then far north, you've got the Gobi Desert, and that just spreads out as far as the eye can see. And the Great Wall, it kind of comes down this black mountain that you're on top of, and it weaves out into the sand, and about 2 kilometres later, it disappears like a worm in the sand. So it's just, you just don't know where to go. It just stops. And so I was sort of looking at this vista, and I was, you know, and the other guys were down the bottom, just, you know, just sort of hanging around in the middle of the day. And I was sort of saying to myself, now, you know, do you really want, you know, I was just really at this moment with myself in terms of, what do I really want to do this? What, you know, what am I here to do? And I just kind of had this little promise to myself that I just made this promise that I was just going to walk all the way to the ocean. And as soon as I said that little promise to myself, there was this flash of sunlight on this rocky outcrop far, far, far to the north, right in the heart of the desert. And I just saw it, and I knew that in that second that was the direction that we had to head. It was like, kind of like a sign, or what we call tohu, that that our Māori ancestors would have looked at when they were sort of about to embark on their massive sea or land migrations in the early days when they were discovering New Zealand or travelling through the country. Back in the old days, in the last 1,000 years or so, really felt like that kind of connection. So I just had this very strong, clear sense that that was the direction we had to head. So I went down the mountain and caught up with the other 4 guys, and they were not too sure what to do, whether we go back to the hotel. And I said, no, we've just got to head this way. And we just walked straight into the desert. And then by the end of the day, when we reached this particular kind of rocky outcrop, there were these 3 tents. And it was basically filled with these Chinese irrigation workers. I think they were fixing up some sort of pipe set up. And it was basically a way of getting some food. And they invited us in, and we had our own tents. But they fed us and gave us this opportunity. And there was no way that I knew that those people were going to be there. But it was just like their calling was so strong. And then we were looked after. And that's basically what the first 3 months of walking the Great Wall of China was like. It was like going into the heart of the Gobi Desert. You don't know exactly where the next village was, where you're going to survive. That the maps, the US era maps that we were using, the villages were so small, it didn't point them out on that map, so we had no idea. We just could sort of work out vaguely where the wall would go when it was there, and just keep on following it in faith, and then basically just keep on walking until eventually we came across a village and we could sort of get our next meal. So we did have some food that we carried with us, like scroggin and noodles, 2 minute noodles, quite light food as we could go. We couldn't carry too much stuff, so we were pretty reliant on the hospitality of the Chinese peasants as we went. But it was very much one of these journeys of, you don't know where the next village is, you just got to keep on going. And I just had faith in the wall that it will provide. So that was kind of, that was sort of the whole sort of initial experience of going to the Gobi Desert.
Right. Now, in the Gobi Desert, would the wall just sort of disintegrate and then you wouldn't know where it connected up again? You'd look in all directions and you couldn't see it, and then you just had to get some sort of sense. Is that how it worked, piece by piece?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, it was quite interesting because usually what they would have is there would be a watchtower on the horizon, and as long as you could see that watchtower, then you'd walk towards that watchtower and then you'd be able to generally see the next one. And so a lot of the wall in between would have dilapidated with either sand dunes had gone over it and dissolved it, or just over time just it withered away. And so we would pretty much try and climb one watchtower, and then you'd be able to spot the next one at that next horizon, sort of head in that direction, and then get to the next one and see the next one. So that was generally the way that we went across the Gobi. A lot of the time, though, we just couldn't see the wall for 3 days, 3 or 4 days. So it had just all gone. So, but the thing was, after we'd been walking this wall for quite a few weeks, you just kind of tuned into the energy of where it would have been, because the way they built it was always in the most beautiful places. It was kind of like, it was almost as if they were building a big ley line across the planet.
I found that fascinating, that part of your book where you talked about, you know, that the strategic reasons for the wall being built probably weren't the reasons, right? Maybe you can just expand on that a little bit, because I really found that interesting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, basically the super brains behind the wall, they needed to get the money from Beijing, from the emperor and his cohorts to complete the wall building. So naturally there was the Mongolian presence up north, the likes of people like Genghis Khan and They're basically actually enemies that would come through that area and invade the villages, the Chinese villages that were settled around where the wall was before their time. But they needed the money to build up those walls to protect those villages. So that's how they got the money. But there's so many places that the wall was existing that didn't really serve any protective purpose at all. And it kind of got us thinking, especially as we really got deep into the journey, as to why did they build this here? There's no way the Mongolian horsemen would either go over that mountain or just go around here. Or that, you know, there was just no point to it. So it just really felt like it was the suzerains were actually just marking the line across. And so once we were walking, especially in the desert, you'd sort of look up at the stars and you'd see how the watchtowers would be all marked out and they'd line up with the stars. It was very similar to experiences I've had when I was experiencing parts of the Camino de Santiago in Spain and visiting the pyramids and different places. It was kind of like little power spots. And so the thing was when the wall wasn't there, after maybe 6 weeks of walking, we just knew where it would be. We just feel the best track to take. And sure enough, 3 days later, the wall would appear again and we would have been right on track. We felt where it was. So there's probably a lot of reasons why that was the case. And in some cases, it was the energy of the building. And other cases, it's the wall's also the world's longest graveyard. So you're perhaps feeling a lot of the men and soldiers that had perished in those areas as well, and feeling their energy. So it was kind of, you had that sense of we were sort of being guided across wherever it was and sort of being looked after. So, yeah, in that sense.
Yeah. How about water? I mean, you're going through the desert. What sort of distance are we talking about between these watchtowers? Was it ever an issue that you could run out of water?
Yeah, I mean, that was what was really interesting, because the thing was, as one stage I was working with my partner from Italy, and all he had was a 1 liter water bottle, and all I had was a 1 liter water bottle and a 750 ml water bottle, which is nothing really to walk.
That's really nothing. No, it's not even a day's worth of water.
Not even a day's worth of water. And the thing is, we learned to just the water is so precious. Water is literally like gold out there. So we would drink it very, very carefully, and only once you come across the village then and had a chance to refill it up with the locals in terms of they'd boil the water and give us some water, or they'd go to a well and we'd get some more water in that way. But it was just a really weird journey in the sense that whatever we needed, as long as we didn't ask for too much, as long as we weren't greedy or we kind of lived in harmony with our environment, then whatever we kind of needed would just come. So when we were getting really low on water, it just seemed that someone would just come out of the blue. And when you saw someone in the desert, because you didn't see that many people in there, you knew, okay, you had to meet that person. That person was going to be helping you out in some way. And then it would often lead to giving you some water to survive on or giving you some food that you needed or telling you a piece of information so that you avoid a potential catastrophe that was hanging out a little bit further down the line that you couldn't see yourself, but you felt like you were being looked after.
Interesting. So did you find that, were there any times, let's say, the energy of the group was off, you know, because you did start this journey as a group of five, correct? Did you ever find, the experience that, you know, that maybe something was up in the group and the energy was off, and therefore, like, the experiences that you were attracting were also kind of reflective of that dynamic? Did you experience that as well?
Yes. Really interesting question, yeah, because the five of us initially, we actually, I mean, I had one friend of mine from New Zealand, and I knew the Argentinian photojournalist who had, he invited me to it. I'd met him a couple of times before we made the trip, but the other two, the monk and the man from Italy, Paolo, we hadn't met until we all got to Beijing. So as it turned out, we all had quite different ideas of how we thought the journey would sort of transpire. So it was, even though we all had that desire, that willingness to go and walk the wall, as it turned out, once we got out there, it was like a couple of the guys were far more interested in just doing a doco for National Geographic. A couple of us were far more interested in just walking the wall and feeling that sort of experience, more having that sort of spiritual walk. And so it was kind of quite, just like, it was almost like some were writers, some were filmmakers, some were the Buddhist monk. He was much more interested in just visiting all the temples around the wall area to see how much Buddhism had re-emerged since the times of the Cultural Revolution and that sort of thing. So we actually had all different ideas, and we were actually only all together for 10 days, and then the monk disappeared, and then after 21 days, the four of us split into two and two, which as it turned out was actually a much easier way to go and walk the wall, because it's just much less pressure on the peasants when you are going into a village and there's five big guys coming in and we're needing to be fed and we haven't eaten and we've just walked 30, 60 k's or whatever, and When there were two of you, it was just a much easier way to have that experience. But it was actually quite hard emotionally, especially for me in particular, to realize that people that you've known for a long time in your life, you know, the journey wasn't going to work very well with those particular relationships. So once we kind of split up in our own different ways, then the journey just flowed so much better in many ways. But also, I mean, there's still amazing experiences on every level, but we just had to be true to whatever our calling, what our intention was of that trip. And once that happened, then the journey was sort of able to unfold more easily, down there.
That's an interesting piece, though. I mean, like there's that clarity and the ability for you to follow through on the clarity of your intention and of your experience, and then, you know, things sort of conspiring to work for you versus when you're not clear, or maybe, you know, you're going along with some dynamics in the group or not necessarily true to your own inner compass, I'd call it, then things can go awry. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Completely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like for example, there were times as well when we split up as a group, and then the trouble really started to begin, and lots of experiences, like a couple of the guys got detained by police and army, and I had a situation where there was we came across some quite bad energy, and there was a kind of a stabbing, a murder experience, or homicide.
Right. Yeah.
As well, so. These things tended to happen when within ourselves, when we were working as a group, you know, when we were split and our egos were taking over too much, and we were trying to be so all about ourselves and all about winning the race and getting there first or whatever. That then those things started to happen. So the war or China was actually just giving us quite hard lessons to say, no, this isn't the way to really go about it. You need to sort of try and work as a team if you can and be more communal and think about others. And so it was quite a good, strong teacher in that way, even though the lessons were quite harsh. But once we kind of link our lessons, then the journey itself will keep on flowing in a more better, positive way. Yeah, so yeah, it's pretty interesting in that way.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. One of the questions that I wrote down for you reading the book was when you talked about, you know, the situation where, quote, if you're anxious about getting to your destination, you're in for a hell of a ride. This thing, right? You know, the sorts of people you attract, it seems, are equally stressed out. You know, it seems that we're kind of, you know, we're on that track here, right? Where you're basically attracting that kind of thing. If you're not in a good place yourself, you're getting that also in your experience, right? And so that you found that, you know, when the group was able to gel and, you know, were able to surrender, I guess, to the experience rather than have their agenda running, that things went well for you. Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I learned that when I was first time I was really hitchhiking properly in my travels, when I was up in Vancouver Island, and I wanted to go hitchhiking to the west coast, to Tofino, and I was waiting at the side of the road, and I was, you know, it was just really interesting. Like, I got dropped off, and there was this bridge, and I thought, oh, that'd be quite a cool experience just to walk across the bridge to see what's below it, and there's a nice spot straight after there where cars could stop, and, you know, and it'd be quite a good place to stop and be hitchhiking. And so this is all before I did the war, but so anyway, so I started to walk across the bridge, and I got really anxious about not being able to get to the main destination. So I put my thumb out as I was walking into the cars that were coming past, and so one car screamed straight past, but the second car actually stopped, and I thought, you know, oh man, actually I don't want this ride. I've missed out on this experience of walking across this bridge and just seeing what's below it and seeing that view and just taking my time. And so the lady that picked me up, I mean, bless her soul, but she was really stressed out, and she had a car accident with one of her mates the day before and was taking me up. She drove really fast, and I got out of that ride, and I was a little bit sort of shaken up, and I thought to myself, no, you just gotta take your time and just have faith that you'll get there in the end, but don't worry about it, don't get too anxious. So I kind of got off that ride and went off the road specifically and just sat down and had some lunch, and these bike riders came, and it was just an amazing experience watching them. It was almost like watching that movie, that Cher, I think it's called Mask, that Cher stars in, and just having this little scene unfold, and then they finished their lunch, they went off, and it just felt like, no, it's time for me to go back to the road again. And sure enough, boom, you know, went back on the road, and there was my ride within 5 seconds, the van came along. So it's just those experiences and using that wisdom to to apply that to the Great Wall experience. So
That leads into another question that I have here about this conversation that you have with Paolo about mental manifestation. You want to tell that story? Because I thought that was fantastic, you know, about what would you eat if you could have anything right now?
Yeah, so he was a very interesting character, and he would, because obviously we're spending these long days in the desert walking, and just to pass the time, the sort of conversations that you have get quite deep and very interesting and on a philosophical level. And so one time we were walking, he just asked me, so what would you like to eat? And I'd sort of, make a joke or whatever, as I used to, but, we kind of worked out the configuration of what was available in the environment that we were in. And then I think I said to him, yeah, noodles, and I'd love an apple, and, maybe some biscuits would be so cool. And then later on that day, you've totally forgotten about that conversation. And you come across a village, and then you're getting fed these noodles, and then there's some apples, and then there's some biscuits. And it was, after a while, it was such a miracle. Every time I was like, oh my God, this is so amazing. This is such a miracle. And then after a while, I was like, actually, no, it's not such a miracle anymore. This is actually just life. This is what happens. And when you're in the desert and you don't have the distractions of the big city with all this people around you or lots of thoughts or lots of ideas or lots of chaos, when you're out in the desert and there's just no distractions, you just notice how your thoughts do manifest. And that was the power of that walk through the Gobi, through that 3 months. And I mean, I know they talk about Jesus going into the desert for 40 days and learning it. I don't know exactly too much about what transpired from that experience, but it really felt like that's the sort of learning that was going on in terms of what we have as human beings, what power we really do have, which is beyond that of, say, people who just focus on making lots of money and that's what it's all about, and they pour their energy into that. It's actually, we don't actually need that. It's a new currency, and it's like it's just what you put your mind to of thinking creates in itself. You don't have to worry about the route to get there. It became more direct. We're straight to the source as opposed to...
That's interesting. So how would you say that the power in that is basically the ability to just not be distracted and to be very clear on your intentions, or what is it? I mean, what's the magic in that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's just not being distracted and being very clear on your intention, just as you've said, and then just sticking and just remembering that intention. That's the challenge. So, what's been going on? Like, for example, when we met the people of the Gobi, the Chinese peasants that were there, for example, money didn't exist at all. The concept hadn't even got in there. So we were like the first Western minds to be bringing those concepts in there. They would just barter their food, grow their crops, pass on food between their neighbours and stuff, and live in this way. And these were pretty much the happiest people I've ever met in my life. I mean, they were amazing. They were so present, so conscious, so giving, like incredible, and just really awesome morals. Not necessarily religious, but they just knew how to be good human beings, knew how to treat strangers, and just incredibly, incredibly happy and full of self-worth. And so these people, we were feeding off these people's mindsets for 3 months, and it was just such a different world where we'd go to give them some money after they look after us, and they just look at us like, what's this? It's not about this. It's the connections through looking at each other in the eyes and passing across the energy in that way, and it's about the experience of sharing our culture. That's the payment. That's the transaction.
Wow. I mean, so there's a real acknowledgement of worth, like of your own individual worth as a human being in that culture then, would you say? I mean, it's not about the currency. It's about, knowing that the connection, the ability to connect with others and to know the value of just being alive, it seems a lot more present.
It's a perfectly put. Yeah, it's such a great point, because it's kind of like the way I looked at it. It was the way of the ancient, and it's the way they've been doing things for the last 10,000 years. And then we've really made, as a species, as a human species, we've gone through massive, massive changes in the last few hundred years. So, which has kind of taken us off. That old path, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with whatever path, it's all learning and experiences and stuff, but when you look at a lot of the crises and the financial problems that are going on, it's actually, that was eventually going to come to a head, because that system isn't so sustainable anymore. It just...
Absolutely, yeah.
Um, just doesn't work. The ideas don't work. So so it kind of lends itself to greed. But other than that, these people were just, they were so inspiring and just to give us that sort of teaching. So when we did come back to the bigger cities like Beijing, it was such a big shock to the system.
What would you say? Like, what happens when in the cities? Then what happens to people? Like, what? You know, the nature of life, what do you think? I mean, what's the key factor that keeps people sort of disconnected from themselves in that urban environment? What is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it is that sense of you're subject to so many different influences, and so there's so many different spurring ways to move this way, move that way. And each conversation, my experience, it makes me, okay, I'll do this for this while, then I'll go and do that. And it's just, life is very, very difficult to stay very focused on one thing. You're very strong and very firm in your beliefs of where you're going. And you have those people for sure. You have incredible leaders in that way. But a lot of the time, it's just like, if you put it in a conceptual level, it's like you've got this nucleus of the atom, and there's all these millions of atoms in the nucleus just buzzing around, buzzing off each other, feeding off each other's energy, generating stuff, building buildings, creating artworks, whatever it is that's happening within that little society. And then outside that nucleus of atom, you've got these kind of more rare individuals, and I'll call it electrons, for example, as a concept, and they're just sort of cruising around the nucleus, and they'll come in from time to time to see that maybe they need to get some money to sustain whatever the activities are outside the nucleus, and then they'll go back out and travel, and then they'll and so you've got those people, and then you might get someone who's got a motorbike and he can go further out, so he'll go maybe two levels of electron out if you're looking at it on an interplanetary kind of context. And so they'll have their experiences, so they're even more broader minded in terms of what they see and what they do. And then you'll have people who are kind of just like asteroids, and they're just cutting through nucleus after nucleus, which is what we were like on the wall. Like, we'd come to one village, and as you come into the center of the little village, it's like you'd see all the old people sitting in the market square, and that's what they do most of the days, with their old age. They didn't have the bodies to be running around and exploring as much as, say, we were. But you'd feed off their energy, and they'd sort of make a comment on you, and you could tell, what they were seeing. It was quite strange to them because those sort of experiences didn't come by too often. And then you'd sort of leave that village and you'd come out and you'd be meeting the people who owned a motorbike and sort of explored a bit further out, and then boom, then you'd be gone from that energy altogether, and then eventually you'd just be in nature, and then you come to the next village and you come to the next nucleus. And it was kind of like that idea. We were like asteroids going through all these kind of mini sort of planets, in that sense. It sounds a little bit out there, but that's kind of the experiences I found it, and just the learning that I got from having that kind of explorer type experience, where you're going from culture to culture and just feeding from each different sort of mindset, really dictates the way that I look at the world now and how I kind of function and sort of hold myself in those sort of environments, whether I'm in or out of the society or not. So
interesting. Yeah. So your ability to sort of transition through different places, right? I mean,
to be honest, when I first came back from China, I had a break, quite a long break, when I was about 3,000 of kilometers through the trip, and I really pushed my body to its absolute limit, so I had to come home and recover, and I did recover, and I found it very, very difficult after being in the wild, out in the wilderness for so long, to re-adapt to the Western world and life that I originally lived. I used to be a lawyer and have these kind of quite full-on sort of driven competitive kind of lifestyles, but what I'm finding now is, now when I do cross between both sides, between the wild and the more kind of domesticated, then it just gets easier, you get more used to making those adjustments, and it's just part of your just life experience, and you know what works for you and what not to do after you've made those mistakes, and just to better fit in a quicker context. So you don't sort of ostracize yourself out for so long if you've been out in the wild for a while. So it's been, in that way, I'm a lot more balanced in that way. Whereas when I was walking the wall, I really did take things to its probably most extreme in terms of getting out there but not going too far, that I couldn't come back to sort of normal.
Well, just, looking at this thing that I noted down here about, I think it's important to mention this at this point, about how, your sense of the vastness of the planet when you're out there. And, you know, you said that your mind became diffuse, expanding through the landscape. I love that. I love that statement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, totally. Like for example, like you'd leave, like every 2 weeks we'd sort of come across a city. So you'd sort of be walking for 2 weeks and just coming across these little villages of maybe, you know, some would have 100 people, some would maybe have 50 people, some maybe have 1,000, a bigger one. And then you come across eventually and then you'd just be in the nature for a few days and just nothing. And then you'd see the city in the distance, it'd be about 50 k's away. And the city would have 3 million people, it'd be the size of New Zealand. And it's just one little Chinese city. And yet, you know, it's quite a substantial place once you get in there. But from the context of where I'd been, walking through all those mountains and those deserts, and you come there and you see this little tiny fragment. It's like a little power shell, abalone shell, just on the beach. That's how small it was, and it's reflecting off the sunlight in the far, far distance. And it just made me think, man, okay, there's a lot of us. There's 7 billion of us now on the planet. I think in October, I think we had 7 billion. But it just compared to where I've been in this sort of very holy, sort of untouched natural world, we just seem so small and insignificant. That's just the feeling that I had. Once you're in there, once you're back in the city, you do realise that that you know you're feeding in China. You know there's probably 1.5 billion people now. You're feeding those people 3 times a day, and the amount that our species is utilising of the resources of the planet is vast. So I mean, how's the planet coping? But the planet is very, very big. So it was that sense of wow. You know, it was so hard to express it. It just made me feel so insignificant, so small and so tiny. But at the same time, having walked those experiences, having walked that history, having walked what was built all that way of that distance, it made me realise what human beings are capable of and just the massive potential we have as a species, which is absolutely mind-blowing. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's good to hold on to that humility and know that, know your place. But at the same time, you use that humility as your strength as to what we can achieve and what we have to face in our challenges in the future as a species in general. So, it's sort of not only go by.
Yeah, so in other words, you know, you still have faith in humanity in order to find some solutions to, you know, the current issues on the planet, you know, mainly in terms of how to forge a sustainable future where we can all thrive, right? And that the Earth can remain intact and in integrity and a place of beauty and resilience, right? So,
I think on that note, I learned a lot from those people in the Gobi because the thing is they had such few resources. I mean, it's a land of very little water. Whatever they could sort of scratch together to have for food, they managed to do that. But they managed to survive despite having no resources. And if, say, the planet was to go down that road where, you know, 2/3 of the planet would have reached desertification levels and have, you know, we've really drained the resources of the planet. It was amazing to see how our species can adapt and can do things. Hopefully we won't have to go down that road. We can sort of be a little bit more forward-looking and realise, okay, we don't need that much to be happy, really. You know, if we just kind of limit our desires and it really just comes down to a psychological level of just sort of...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's very interesting. And from our launch call on Friday, you know, the point was brought up with our speakers then about how, you know, this quest for more, 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 it comes from an internal sort of inability to acknowledge our own value, and therefore we're looking on the outside for more. You know, so I just find, you know, that what you're bringing up here and like this people that were out there and their simple lives and, you know, that they don't need a lot to be happy, right? Because there's this sort of understanding of what real value is. Now, if you'd like to comment on that, I'd love it.
that's exactly what it was. And the thing was, they were very special. I really felt like I was so privileged to have had spent that time with those people, because when I did go back to Beijing after 3 months walking through the Gobi, and I mean, to put it in context, my Chinese wasn't very good. We were really communicating through just looking each other in the eyes and gesturing, and it got to a level where you're almost reading each other's minds to communicate for most of our needs.
Wow.
Just because my language at that stage, at that early stage in China, was so limited. When I got back to Beijing, it was so interesting. You're back in the city and you're back where people are cutting deals and they're trying to outdo the other, and I just looked at these guys' faces and it was just so blaringly obvious when people were lying to me or they had some agenda. I could just so clearly read what was going through their minds, because that's just the way I was communicating for all those months.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with the people who were out in the desert is that this wasn't an agenda. It was just, they just were, for want of a better word, they were the natural human animal. There was just no sort of personality or agenda to sort of dictate what they were doing, and so there's no deviousness. Whereas when I went to the big cities and it was about, you know, getting the money to whatever you needed for whatever your goal was, you know, you could see that deviousness, you could see those kind of agendas so glaringly obvious after that amount of time. So it's just fascinating how it all works.
I would almost at this point, I'd like to just, you know, jump to this sort of statement or summary, is that the farther that you get away from your connection to nature, to the human animal that you are, it's like, you know, the harder it is to really understand and what your value is as a human being.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because, I mean, for some people, they'll use their culture. Like I know a lot of my Māori friends and cousins and brothers and stuff, you know, they'll really stick to their Māori culture as their form of value and their way of being. And I know that many times in my life where I will stick to those values just to find my sense of self-worth and value as a human. And other people will stick to their religion, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or Islam. And that's their kind of beacon of direction in terms of what keeps them valued as a human being. So there's, and for some it's, you know, that pursuit of money or wealth or material well-being, or for another person it might be just getting a girlfriend or whatever, you know, whatever it is that makes that person strong. So everyone has their own kind of different types of religions, in quotation marks, so to speak, that makes them, you know, feel like whatever it is that the truth that they're exploring. So it's very hard you can't judge anyone. It's just, or you want to observe what you judge of other people, because if you start to judge other people because of what they're doing, because it's different to you, then you just got to ask yourself the question, well, why am I thinking that the way I'm doing is right, you know, as opposed to their way? And that's when conflict arises. So it's sort of having that awareness. I learned a lot through that 65 countries or whatever it was of traveling, just being around those different cultures and realizing, man, actually, okay, they are different. They're a different type of animal. But it's fascinating, and I'm really interested, and I'll learn what I can from it. And some parts of that animal I'm not going to like. That's just not going to work for me, because I just haven't been brought up that way. But there'll be some parts which are like really amazing, and I think, cool, oh, that's a really cool value that I might try and bring that into my life, bring that into my way of being, and change myself down that way. And I definitely think my travels have influenced me, hopefully for the better, in that way of being open enough to take on what other people have to share with you and stuff like that.
Mm. Or to identify different parts of yourself maybe that you didn't know were in there, but, you know, upon seeing that, you know, in the external world, that was that.
Completely, yeah. I mean, I lived in the Middle East and Europe and in Asia and in South Africa as well, just where it was like, whoa, you know, it was almost like that sense, like, I remember being in Wadi Rum in Jordan, and it's like this very clear feeling, well, I've been here, you know, this feels very comfortable for me. And in fact, the first half of the war, it felt like I'd been there too. Well, not me per se, but my ancestors had walked through those paths, because it just flowed so well. And I'd felt that. And when I walked the second half of the war, then it was like I knew no one had been there of my ancestors or anyone, because I was forging that path out for the first time. It was so hard. It was 17 difficult months of experience to reach that, so I really felt like I was forging it. Whereas when I look back at the history of the people, what was happening was they had sort of walked all the way through China, Asia, come down to the Middle East, down through Asia, come down through the Himalayas and into Cambodia, down to Southeast Asia, and settled, and then eventually got in the canoes, went to the the islands, and then around 1000 AD made their way, eventually 800 to 1000 AD made their way slowly to New Zealand. So you kind of could sense those old migration routes and sense mm-hmm. where you had the new places where they hadn't been. So that was kind of those kind of experiences. And I was just being in touch with those, well, being sensitive enough to feel those kind of old energies and why you were drawn there to go there. And so, yeah, it brings up a lot of questions. You know, it could be past life stuff, or it could be just migrational, what your ancestors were up to, and that having their knowledge as part of your genetic coding or genetic knowledge.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, okay, now this is not, I would say that this sort of awareness that you embody is, you know, I don't feel that a lot of people know that they have access to that. Can you talk about that? I mean, your own ability to feel these energies and to see the signs and to be supported in your life by, you know, by life itself. Can you talk about how you do that? How you use your own inner compass to navigate your life?
It's interesting. It's something I've been working on for years, because I remember when I first went to UC Davis and I was finishing my law degree, I'd got a scholarship from New Zealand and did my last year in California, finished my law degree, and I had a lot of freedom. All of a sudden I was outside of my kind of lifestyle, where the first sort of 18, 19, 20 years was very much you go to school and you're a sheep, you know, you're herded through the channels, and I did a good job. I really enjoyed it. It was very, things just worked very well. I obeyed instructions very well and had a very successful early career because I followed those kind of, for want of a better word, those kind of herding fences very well, very, very clearly. And then I got to a stage where all of a sudden you're just out in a big open paddock and you can go anywhere. And so it's like, well, where do you go? And so I'd be on my bike in Davis and I could go right or left towards the university where I was heading ultimately. And so I just try and spend the time before choosing, what's my intuition? Which way does that want me to go? Does it want me to go right or left? And I'll just follow that today just to see what happens and just see what I come across if by taking that way to university that day. So I did a lot of work on that for all those times when I was traveling, because you've got the freedom to mm-hmm. open yourself to those experiences. And I found after a while you get so in tune with your intuition and generally it seemed to help you out from the experiences I had. So when I was on the wall, if I followed my intuition, boom, it would be leading us to some food or something really important to survive. If I didn't follow it, and I'd notice it, I'd go the other side of the wall, if there was a gap, for example, then I'd look back on the way that I didn't go, and I'd see, oh, there's a group of people there having lunch. I missed that experience because I didn't follow my intuition. So in some ways, I don't know who's guiding you or what's happening, but there's something that within our human capabilities that if you do tap into it, in some ways it puts you at an advantage to what's out there, to what's available to help you on your dream or your journey or your experience. So yeah, it's definitely something to tap into and work on if you're open to it in that way.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably, you know, a lot of leaders, or this is called leaders' call to adventure, right? I mean, this is, I feel, probably a very important quality of leadership is the ability to really follow your own inner direction and use that to take a stand, you know, because if you're leading, that, I mean, how do you lead? You know, you're not following if you're leading, right? You're leading. So where do you, you know, how, what informs your decision, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's the huge challenge of life. Is, you know, because you're not always going to be the leader. You have to know how to follow to also lead as well. So it's and you need to know both sides to be effective in both jobs. I believe, but I have a lot of times in my life where I'm like, you know, okay, what am I doing next? Where am I going? And I do need to go and have that time on myself, on my own, just to connect with who I am and what I need, where I need to be going, and then re-identify with whatever it is that my calling might be, because mm-hmm. it's very easy to jump on someone else's bandwagon, whether it be a corporate structure or some person that inspires you immensely, or a family member or whatever it is that you feel you're following for a bit. But I find if I start doing that for too long, then I get a lot of warnings and a lot of signs of things happen to me which make me think, okay, you can carry on with this path if you want, but it's not necessarily going to be in your best interest or in terms of what perhaps life really wants. Has planned for you or what or wants you to be doing is probably a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
So yeah, so you sort of get in touch with your own sort of internal compass again and gravitate and just basically ground yourself again and start from scratch again and then go back to that leadership role. But I like following as well. I think it's really, really valuable. So that's what it wants and what works for you at the time.
Yeah, well, what do you think? I mean, what was the key quality that got you through this journey that, you know, what was it that got you through to the end of this 4,000-kilometer walk? What was it?
It's kind of interesting. I was blindly driven to do this experience. So it was intense focus, intense passion, and almost obsession, probably the best word is obsession. You know, I was utterly obsessed to get to the end. So even when I was back at home recovering and I'd be cycling my bike, it was never off my mind. You know, I'd be like, how am I going to get back? How am I going to do this? How am I going to... It was like such a strong addiction. I'm not saying that this is necessarily that healthy. It wasn't, you know, because I mean, I was very lucky to have survived the journey. But that's what it took. It took blind obsession, and the same with writing the book. It was actually even harder writing the book because you're stuck in that cave, you know, right? You don't have those horizons to inspire you to keep going. It's easy when you're just like, oh, cool, what's on the next horizon? I naturally like that, but it was just that no, get to the end of that goal, and just what at all costs. I mean, you're still going to verge off. That's part of your life experience, but that just became my backbone. That became my kind of my rock to keep going back to. For many people, that will be just a key relationship, or they will be their rock, and then they'll verge off from there. But the war for me very much was my kind of sense of identity at that particular time. So, yeah, it's interesting. And like I used to date a doctor in Cape Town, and she was she's trained to be a surgeon. She got 5 years of this surgery training, and her focus is so driven. I could see me when I was on the wall, that kind of blind obsession. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, I can look back at that.
Okay. We've lost you here. Hello?